I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, Clinton, Obama, Brownback, Richardson, look out. The air is filled with hats flying into the presidential ring. But first, President Bush and big business both address greenhouse gases this week. The president is expected to announce voluntary limits on carbon emissions in his State of the Union address tomorrow. That's a shift for the White House, but not enough of a shift for a coalition of environmental groups and major U.S. companies, including General Electric, the chemical giant Dow, and the oil company BP, which today called on Congress and the president to set a mandatory cap on greenhouse gases. For more, we're joined by Eileen Claussen, who's president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. She's a member of this new coalition, which is called the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, or U.S. CAP, and she's speaking to us from very busy Capitol Hill. Eileen, what exactly is your group calling for?
We are actually calling for a comprehensive program to deal with greenhouse gases. The cornerstone is a mandatory cap and trade, and we have very specific targets and timetables that we recommend. But we also understand that you have to do things beyond cap and trade, things to do with coal in particular, with transportation, which is a third of the problem, and with building efficiency as well.
Cap and trade, this is a program in which power plants that don't meet the reduction targets can buy credits, if you will, from companies that do reduce their emissions.
Yes, although it's actually not restricted to electricity providers. We are talking about all major sources, chemical plants, aluminum plants. There are a lot of energy-intensive industries who do emit significant amounts of greenhouse gases, and we believe that they, too, need to be part of the cap and trade. For example, our group includes DuPont, which is a major energy-intensive company. It includes Alcoa, which produces aluminum, and which has actually had a very rigorous, both of those companies, a very rigorous program to reduce their own emissions.
Well, that raises a lot of questions, because as you know, the president is expected to announce his policy change on greenhouse gases tomorrow night. We're not sure exactly what he'll say, but it's well known that he's against mandatory caps, that he believes in market solutions, and will probably suggest programs that encourage companies to cut carbon emissions by offering incentives like tax credits. If some of the companies in your group were already doing this on their own, why isn't that the answer? Why isn't it the answer that companies take it upon themselves to do this without regulations?
For one thing, it's the best companies that are taking action voluntarily. We actually need all companies to take action because our emissions, despite the efforts of some of these companies, have been growing over the last 10 or 15 years. And that is the wrong direction. We ought to be reducing our emissions. That's number one. The second is that I think most of business would like some certainty. They would like to know where we're going so they can make the investments necessary to get us there. And without a mandatory program, you simply won't have the certainty that you need to put large amounts of money into new technologies, the ones that we're going to need in a carbon-constrained world.
Why a cap and trade? This is where a company might still have emissions but could buy credits from other companies that curtail their emissions. That still allows very rich companies to maybe even increase their pollution if they can afford to buy credits from other companies that comply with the regulation. So why not a straightforward cap without the trade?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is that different companies can achieve different emission reductions at different costs. With a cap and trade, we can meet the environmental goal because we set the cap. But by allowing trading, we can make sure that the reductions are taken where they are most cost-effective.
One last question for you, Eileen, before we go. We know that Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has set up a committee to deal exclusively with climate change. Republican Senator, possible presidential candidate John McCain, is pushing for a cap on greenhouse gas emissions. So this is a bipartisan issue. You've been on the Hill. What are legislators saying?
Actually, in the meeting that we just had, there was great enthusiasm for what we're doing and a recognition that now that business is an advocate for something, that there's a much better chance of actually getting something passed.
And your thoughts on this, what is being perceived as this huge shift in the White House?
It's in the right direction, but if the president still is going to maintain the view that voluntary action is best, we just think that's not enough.
Eileen Claussen, again, a member of the U.S. CAP, a coalition of 10 companies and 4 environmental groups calling for federal action on greenhouse gas emissions. And she's doing that in a very busy Capitol Hill. Eileen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm in to win, and that's what I intend to do. Thank you all very much.
New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton at her first presidential campaign event yesterday, and already the accusations are flying. A conservative magazine reports that Barack Obama, who announced last week, of course, hid the fact that he was educated in a Muslim madrasa, and some right-wing talk show hosts are saying Hillary leaked that rumor. In a moment, we'll hear what they both have to say about this. But first, also this weekend, two other presidential contenders announced they're in. Conservative Senator Sam Brownback told supporters at a rally on Saturday that his pro-life views would guide him.
Whether it is here, whether it's in the womb, whether it's somebody in poverty, whether it's a child in Darfur, they're all sacred and beautiful, and let's start protecting them.
And New Mexico's Hispanic Governor Bill Richardson announced online in Spanish and English, then told ABC's This Week how he'd get the U.S. out of Iraq, starting with a timetable for withdrawal.
You set national reconciliation talks with the three ethnic groups. You talk to Iran and Syria. What we need to do is bring their neighbors in.
Well, joining us on the line are some veteran watchers of politics. Lee Bandy has covered the politics for the state newspaper of South Carolina since 1966. Lee, welcome as always.
Well, thank you, and how are you?
I'm just fine. Lynn Sweet is D.C. bureau chief for the Chicago Sun-Times. She joins us as well. Lynn, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel up there in Keene, New Hampshire. Guy, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Robin.
And I hear, Guy, that you're one of the only ones that's, I mean, I guess this rumor's been flying around about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And let's just get it out of the way, first of all. Have you heard about this rumor? It was spread after an article in the conservative magazine Insight, which accused Obama of hiding the 4 years he spent as a teenager at a Muslim madrasa in Indonesia.
Yeah, I think maybe we need a word better than conservative. Insight is one of those Rupert Murdoch infections. And the thing went from there to Fox News and Fox Television. Apparently it's nonsense. I mean, Obama says it's nonsense. And the timing seems odd because usually these kinds of slurs come in the day just before an election.
What do you think that means? That it's, you know, we haven't even rounded the corner. Nobody's even formally declared. They're just announcing exploratory committees.
I don't know. I think we're in for a rough ride this year and the beginning of next or through next year. I'm a little disappointed in the Obama thing, though. I wish it were true because I think it'd be good to have a candidate who knows something about Islam because the current officials don't seem to know much about it.
Okay, if I may.
Yeah.
There is no evidence that Hillary Clinton's troops did anything, and even to repeat that, I think, is a little irresponsible.
Well, she is soundly denying the rumor, and we should say
unless you know something on something like that, to start speculating on who is leaking what when you're not even in the reporting trenches yourself is kind of hard to know. But from the bit I know and the players and how things work, it's not only unlikely, but I could tell you who the biggest leaker is in terms of Obama's background about his schooling, and that is Senator Obama himself, because he wrote about it in his book. So there isn't a lot of place to go here. The only, I suppose, bit of biography to know more about is the nature of the Muslim school he went to, and there's nothing in the Insight story that had any information that would make you think that it was any, depending on what word you use to describe a Muslim school, that is known.
And well, he has made a statement. He says he attended a Catholic school in Jakarta, and you're absolutely right. He wrote about this in his best-selling books, and that it was a non-religious but predominantly Muslim school. And, Lynn, I do want to ask you to pick up, though, on what we're hearing, as Guy was alluding to, you know, viciously in some cases in the media, this sort of preemptive attack on him as someone whose middle name is Hussein, who, you know, might have gone to a school with Muslims. I mean, how is that kind of mud resonating where you are, if at all?
Well, I don't know about resonating since I'm not taking any surveys on that, but I could help you analyze, I suppose, what this campaign is telling us already is that there is quite a bit of, unfortunately, quite a bit of anti-Muslim sentiment out there. And nowhere more is it triggered than when people got to know Senator Obama better and realize that his middle name is Hussein. See, some of this is interesting to me because it's never been a secret. I mentioned it in a story I wrote about him in January of 06, and not one comment came in anyway, anyhow, about it. He doesn't particularly hide it. He just doesn't use it as his campaign name. Actually, one of his he has a joke about it, and that is he didn't think he could get a worse ballot name than Barack Obama, and anyone who's going to care about it, you know, he can't do anything about that.
Lee, that's Lynn in Chicago at the Chicago Sun-Times, very familiar with the story of Barack Obama. But how about where you are in South Carolina? Is his, you know, pitching his hat into the ring or saying that he's going to explore it, how's that resonating there?
Well, we hear that he's coming down here next month, and of course he has not been here at all. He did come down here 2 years ago to campaign for a U.S. Senate candidate, but no one knew that much about him back then, and so he did not draw large crowds. But I'm sure that when he comes down this time, he will attract a large crowd. And you know, I think that the South Carolina primary is one of the primaries that could send Barack on his way. But our Democratic primary will be 50% black. And it'd be interesting to see how that plays out as the time goes on. But right now, when you talk to the ranking file Democrats here in South Carolina, they are they're a little leery of Hillary. They're scared of Hillary. They think she would be a drag on the ticket here in South Carolina, and they may be right. And then Osama, he's lacks experience. So Joe Biden is getting a lot of attention here.
Huh, the Delaware senator. Tell us more. Why? Is it his new profile on Iraq?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Is it because of his new profile on Iraq?
And Joe Biden, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
That has a lot to do with it. I was at a Columbia Rotary Club where Biden spoke several weeks ago, and that is a Republican club inside out. And he had these Republicans eating out of his hand, and afterwards I had several Republicans come to me and say, you know, I could vote for Joe Biden.
Because?
Because of...
Did you say could or couldn't?
I'm sorry?
Did you say they said they could or couldn't?
They could.
They could?
Yeah.
Ah, because of what did he say in specific?
Well, Joe Biden puts on a good show. He's good on his feet. He's a good public speaker. He got out and walked around the tables and answered questions, you know, a la Liddy Dole. And he just was a big hit.
Huh. Well, we are talking about this, what's become over the weekend, a very crowded field. We want, of course, look on the Republican side of people tossing their hat into the ring to explore a run for the presidency in 2008. That's Lee Bandy. He covers politics for the State Newspaper of South Carolina. Lynn Sweet's with us. She's in D.C. She's the bureau chief there for the Chicago Sun-Times. Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel. Guy, when we come back, I want to start with you. How's all of this playing out in the first in the nation primary state of New Hampshire? We'll start with you right after the break. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking about the crowded field of presidential wannabes with journalists in some key states. Lee Bandy is with the State Newspaper in South Carolina. Guy McMillan is with the Keene Sentinel in New Hampshire. And also we have Lynn Sweet, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times. And as promised, Guy, I want to just start with you. How are all the, you know, the recent announcements resonating up in New Hampshire? I was just up there last week for an event, and there are 11-year-olds who get excited about the candidates coming through. What's the feeling up there about some of the new announcements?
Well, I think there's still more interest on the part of the political activists than there is in the street. But Obama certainly did quite a job here a few weeks ago when he came and gave a speech that was greeted with almost awe by the audience. Speaking of his name, by the way, he's got a great line. This man is not a deer-in-the-headlights kind of candidate. You can hit him with anything, and he'll come back with something that's cleverer than you imagined. He talks about his name, saying people used to think his name was Yo Mama, and the audience went crazy. He said, so, you know, if they can just remember part of it, he'd be happy. McCain on the Republican side, there's a new poll out. I don't believe in polls, but, hey, that's what we're doing here. This one shows him to be declining somewhat in popularity, which is probably not surprising in a state where a lot repeatedly these days.
Well, let's stay with the Republican side for just a second. I want to bring in Lynn Sweet, because we also heard Sam Brownback throw his hat in the ring or talk about it over the weekend. Mitt Romney, Massachusetts governor. You know, we have the chance in this presidential election for potential first woman, first African-American, potentially first Mormon. How are some of these new names resonating in Chicago? I know you're in D.C., but how are they resonating?
Well, I wish I could help you. I don't know. I'm not there.
Well, what are your thoughts?
Ask me something I can help you with. I cover Obama a lot. I cover the presidential race a lot. I could talk about, let me maybe try this, because I don't like to fake reaction to people.
No, fine.
I'm not at. So I think the historic nature of the race is important. I also think, though, it's hard to, these races are very distinct. By that I mean the Republican primary and the Democratic primary. So it's hard to, it's like mixing, it's a bit of a mixing to say how will Mitt Romney's race necessarily impact, to think that it might impact the Democratic race is something. I think what it does for the people who are lucky enough to live in the early primary states is make everything very interesting, because they're seeing people talk and hearing conversations that probably never happened before in terms of some of these historic firsts. And you're, I don't know if your listeners know, but they probably do, they are so close to New Hampshire, where there is going to be the first presidential debate just in April, that so many of your people could just go up and, take the temperature themselves and see all the people go. Hillary Clinton's going to be in Iowa this weekend. Obama will start his primary travels after he announces on February 10. And I would expect Senator Clinton to be in New Hampshire in sometime in March.
Well, I want to pick up on something that Guy said and ask you, Lee Bandy. You know, talking about John McCain's numbers perhaps slipping just a bit, he was on Meet the Press again this weekend defending the president's policy. He even said, I don't know, this jumped out for me, he even said that he had an exchange with General David Petraeus, who's going to be in charge of the ground troops in Iraq, who assured him, McCain, that if Petraeus needed more than the 21,000 troops that were in the surge, he could get them. What is your sense on how strong McCain's stand is? How is it resonating in South Carolina? How is Iraq resonating there?
Well, Iraq is not the popular war that it once was. And South Carolina is a very conservative state. It's a very patriotic state. It's pro-military. And the latest poll I saw down here showed that less than 40% of the South Carolina voters now supported the war, and that is a big turnaround here in South Carolina. And that could hurt McCain some. We have a lot of National Guardsmen who are in Afghanistan, and some more being shipped off soon to Afghanistan and to Iraq. And so the families here of these soldiers are alarmed at this growth of the military. And so I think that McCain better be careful here. I mean, they think they have a lock on South Carolina. They do not have a lock on South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. And Guy McMillan, we're just a day away from the President's State of the Union. What are people in New Hampshire saying they want to hear about? I mean, do they need further explanation on Iraq? We hear, as we just said, that the president's going to be focusing in a shift on global warming, climate change. How's it going to resonate?
It's hard to say. I think people have heard all they need to hear from this president. And there's not a whole lot of curiosity on the subject of the State of the Union. He already talked about Iraq till he was blue in the face. He's now apparently going to offer some program to allow us to buy health insurance, which isn't exactly, I think, what most people had in mind.
Well, and, what's interesting here, though, is that the issue of health is going to get back on the table. Senator Clinton, it's in a sense, seems to want to use someone else's phrase, to bring it on, because I think she knows that as soon as you talk about health care and to push his plan of tax breaks for self-employed is might be a little esoteric for some who just wonder where they could get health insurance. I think Senator Clinton knows that she has to get through with people this Hillary care, a monkey on her back.
Right.
And she's got to answer the questions where she's been for 13 years since it
was. Well, actually, she has been active on some of the health care issues. She sponsored, but in far more of a micro way than in a macro way.
We've still got a couple of 100,000 people here in New Hampshire that
don't
have
I couldn't hear. What's that?
He's saying there's a great number of people still in New Hampshire without health care, which, you know, is part of his thoughts, that that's what they're going to want to hear about.
Oh, universal health care is going to be part of what the Democrats are talking about as a group. Obama's interested in it, and so is Hillary. And here's how they're going to approach it, though.
Well, we got 28 seconds.
Pro-business. Okay, I'll wrap it up quick. It will be seen as a pro-business move to help businesses cap health care costs.
That's Lynn Sweet, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times. We'll be listening for that. We also heard from Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel up there in Keene, New Hampshire. Lee Bandy has covered politics for the state newspaper of South Carolina since 66. We always appreciate you as well. And we'll do this another time. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice traveled to the Arab world last week to garner diplomatic support for U.S. policies in Iraq and many in the region, including some activists, noted that she did not meet with civil rights leaders and made no mention of human rights abuses. So what happened to the push for democracy in U.S. allies? Middle East historian Toby Jones is a visiting professor at Pennsylvania Swarthmore College. He joins us now. And Tony, remind us, Egypt and Saudi Arabia, key states in the region, both important U.S. allies, but quite different from each other. What is the leadership in each country?
Well, Saudi Arabia is a monarchy ruled over by a single family, the Al Saud, which has been in power since early in the 20th century. Egypt, on the other hand, is sort of roughly a republic controlled mostly by a figurehead, Hosni al-Mubarak, who sits atop the leading party, the National Democratic Party in Egypt. And Mubarak has been in power since early in the 1980s, shortly after Sadat's death.
And where does democracy stand in each country?
Well, it doesn't stand anywhere at this point. Both countries, although they experimented briefly with issues of political reform within the last 3 or 4 years, have seen democracy weaken and falter as a result of growing or a return to authoritarianism in both of those places.
In fact, as Condoleezza Rice made her visit to Egypt, the papers, we understand, were filled with stories of police sodomizing a bus driver, which was a video that showed up on the Internet, according to the New York Times. In another video on cell phones showing up in Egypt, police were hanging a woman by her knees and questioning her. So it's not just that democracy isn't rising. It seems to be the reverse.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, in fact, when the United States was willing to put pressure on these governments as the initial part of the Bush administration's push for democracy in the region, I think it was tangible. You saw the emergence of local reform, democratizing lobbies, social groups, and political networks that exerted internal pressure on those governments. Those have largely dissipated as a result of government crackdowns.
And let's talk about some of the movements in each country that had at least some life. In Egypt, the Kafaya movement?
Well, it emerged several years ago as a domestic protest movement against Mubarak, a network that argued for a change in leadership and a change in institutional structures. But after the presidential elections in Egypt, in which Mubarak was elected once again, the government cracked down quite heavily on Kafaya, and their leadership has largely been put in prison or co-opted or oppressed, and the movement is somewhat in tatters at this point.
And the other movement that seems to be more intact is the Muslim Brotherhood?
Correct. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood has a long history in Egypt dating back to 1928 when it was initially founded. It was oppressed in the 1950s and 60s to see something of a resurgence in the late 70s. Recently, when it burst back onto the political scene, won seats in the most recent parliamentary elections, and really is the most effective and single largest opposition political association in Egypt. The government sees the Brotherhood as a direct threat to political power.
What about Saudi Arabia? What are any movements toward democracy there?
In 2003 in Saudi Arabia, the emergence of a reform lobby was visibly noticeable, writing petitions, gathering signatures, and putting direct pressure on the royal family, pushing for the end of corruption and political reform. They gained some traction in 2003 and 2004. They were successful enough to help create the first municipal council elections in Saudi Arabia in 40 years in early 2005. Although in the 2 years since, they've largely dissipated and disappeared from public view.
And that brings us to the now and Iraq. How much has what's happened in Iraq affected both Egypt and Saudi Arabia. A Shia-led government has risen up in Iraq, replacing the Sunni government under Saddam Hussein. Tell us how that's affected both Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Egypt has become quite alarmed and alarmist about this rising Shia power, but for reasons that really only make sense in terms of the whole geopolitics of the region. That is, that Egypt wants to maintain a relationship with Saudi Arabia and the United States and leverage the Americans into a particular position, one that won't threaten the political hegemony of Mubarak. Saudi Arabia faces a much more serious dilemma in the sense that Iran is really the only other powerful country in the Gulf, and it sees the potential rise of Shia Iraq as a tipping point. That is, that a Shia Iraq could bring the region under the influence of Iran rather than Saudi Arabia, which could threaten all kinds of things, political stability. Saudi Arabia has its own large Shia community that actually lives astride all its oil reserves, and so any restive force there could be destabilizing.
So how much are the concerns about the Shia government in Iraq a part of the U.S. language now in Saudi Arabia and Egypt? We just spoke of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's visit. How much are those concerns playing into the fact that the U.S. is backing off of criticizing both Egypt and Saudi Arabia for their human rights violations?
In a sense, what's happened is that Saudi Arabia has become so alarmed, or at least has claimed to become so alarmed, that it's using the sectarian issue to pursue a decidedly authoritarian politics at home and a much more aggressive politics in the region.
And this is where our conversation began, and this is what has some critics questioning whether the U.S. should be doing more to criticize those practices. And as you've been saying, perhaps the U.S. Sees the need for Saudi Arabia and Egypt to help resolve the issues of Iraq. But some are wondering if, in fact, Egypt in particular still carries the weight that it once did. Egypt wasn't able to stop the fighting between Palestinian factions or reduce the violence in Lebanon.
Well, that's right. And I think that sort of exemplifies the limits on Egypt's abilities to affect events on the ground elsewhere in the region.
Toby, it would seem, like a simplistic question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. One of the goals of the U.S. in Iraq was to bring democracy to the region. What has been the actual effect of that?
The effect has been not only are we not seeing more democracy in the region, the Iraq war has had the exact opposite consequence, in the sense that democracy as a political possibility in the Middle East has largely evaporated.
Evaporated? That's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah, well, I think that all indications are that Sunni governments, and not necessarily just Sunni governments, but governments across the board in the Middle East have seen themselves under threat initially from the Iraq war and the democracy promotion talk to being actually in a position that's quite advantageous, in the sense that the Americans are no longer able to leverage those governments to pursue serious domestic reform. And so they're actually able to redouble their efforts in turning back any kind of political reforms that they might have made in the late 1990s and the early 21st century. So in that sense, democracy not only has lost momentum and has largely become an unreality in the Middle East, but democracy has actually become an instrument. So, and by this sense, I mean the holding of elections, the promotion of limited institutional and political reforms, has actually become an instrument in creating more authoritarian governments in the Middle East.
That's Swarthmore College Middle East historian Toby Jones. Toby, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, still to come today, how a midwife in the West African nation of Mali, who ironically died in childbirth, is now helping other African women have a better life, as her story is told in a lovely new book, Monique and the Mango Rain. Still to come, you're listening to Here and Now. Wait a minute, didn't we just say at around this time last Friday that Tom Brady could possibly be the best quarterback of all time? Didn't we just say that? Well, as it turns out, his good friend Peyton Manning may have been the better quarterback last night, unleashing the greatest comeback in AFC Championship history, leading the Indianapolis Colts to victory over the New England Patriots and sending the Colts on to the Super Bowl, where they'll face the Chicago Bears, who took a minute or two but then roared past the New Orleans Saints. Boston Herald sports writer Dan Ventura was at last night's Patriots-Colts game. He's fresh off the plane back to Boston. Dan, it was probably a pretty sad ride home.
There were a couple of Colts fans on the plane, so I guess there were at least two people who were smiling.
Well, what happened? Peyton Manning, Colts quarterback, was known as the guy who maybe could play during the regular season but couldn't do the big game. Tom Brady, on the other hand, was known as the guy who just, refused to lose in the big games. What happened?
Yes, and yes. It's one of those wild games where a lot of times in the playoffs you're going to get momentum swings, but sometimes they happen from quarter to quarter, or even in the Bears game earlier it was half to half. In last night's game, it literally was minute to minute. The first half, Manning couldn't have looked any worse. The Patriots basically had the nail in the coffin and just couldn't bang it in. And then in the second half, Manning reverted to being Manning, and 32 points against a Bill Belichick team, that doesn't happen overnight.
Well, let's just say the thing we haven't said: the Patriots blew a 21-3 lead.
They had a 21-3 lead and had the ball driving. Mm. And then Troy Brown gets hit for an offensive pass interference, which was a good call, but it took away a chance of them even getting more points there. And I really think even if you get a field goal there, you're possibly looking at 24-3 at the half. But they got nothing out of that drive. Manning winds up bringing them down the field. Now, they only get a field goal, but now you're looking at 21-6 at the half, which really is only a two-touchdown game. And for a team like the Colts, two touchdowns is not much to overcome. And as it turned out, they did it in less than 10 minutes and added the two-point conversion measure to tie the game.
The other game yesterday between the Saints and the Bears, the Saints came out of the gate strong. That 88-yard pass from quarterback Drew Brees to newcomer Reggie Bush, who taunted the Bears that were coming after him. He sort of like waggled his finger at them, and then he flipped into the end zone for a touchdown.
Have you ever done one of those flips?
When I was maybe 8. First of all, how amazing was that play?
It was a heck of a play. I mean, you got to give the guy credit. For most people, it's probably a 20 or 30-yard pass, but he's just so good that he turns it into an 88-yard touchdown, and he was blown away from the guys at the end.
But was he perhaps taunting and flipping a little too early?
Let's just say there were a few people in the press box in Indianapolis who didn't take kindly to it, thought it was really, to take a pun on his word, Bush League.
Well, but then, the Bears came back big time.
They got the last laugh. The Bears looked like they had the game well in hand, up 16-0. The Saints score at the end of the half. And then in the Bush touchdown, all of a sudden, here's a game where the Bears that dominate, but you look at the scoreboard, it's 16-14. And then the Saints get the ball and are driving again, but then missed the field goal. And from that point on, it seemed like, the Bears just regained that, that word again, the momentum, and just the last 20 minutes was just a fast break to Miami for them.
Right. Well, let's take a look forward to the Super Bowl in 2 weeks. There's been an assumption that the AFC team is going to walk over the NFC champion. Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I think if you look at it on paper, I think the Colts are clearly the better team. They're a far better offensive team. Defensively, they've gotten better. They're going to go against the Bears team that probably doesn't have as many weapons, per se, as New England.
Well, you don't hear about Rex Grossman, the quarterback, for instance, as much as you hear about Peyton Manning.
Or Tom Brady, for that matter.
Right.
This guy, every game, is scrutinized and dissected. I mean, there was talk at the end of the regular season. Is Grossman going to be the starter in the playoffs?
Well, we can't let you go without noting the other thing that everyone is talking about. This is going to be the first Super Bowl with not one but two teams coached by African-Americans, Lovie Smith for the Bears and Tony Dungy for the Colts. How significant is this?
Obviously, it's huge. I think it opens up probably more doors for African-American coaches. These owners who may have shied away from this in the past will look, hey, you've got two guys who are in the Super Bowl. You have Herm Edwards of the Chiefs who made the playoffs. Maybe it's not such a taboo anymore to have an African-American installed as a head coach.
Right. It's going to be a wonderful image. No matter who wins, there will be an African-American hoisting a Super Bowl trophy.
Firing anything crazy, yes. Absolutely.
That's Boston Herald sports writer Dan Ventura talking about last night's big games and the Super Bowl ahead. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In 1989, Chris Holloway was a college senior in Ohio, handed a slip of paper telling her where she'd serve her Peace Corps stint. Chris spoke French, and unlike some of her friends, she knew that Mali was a poor country in West Africa and not an Hawaiian island. But there was a lot she didn't know.
I didn't know that I would meet and befriend Monique Dembélé, a village midwife, and spend my 2 years at her side. I didn't know that I would fall in love with another Peace Corps volunteer. I also didn't know the immensity of the sky when there's nothing to tarnish its glory. Unpolluted by electric lights, uncrowded by tall buildings, without a drop of humidity in the air. Nor did I know that my friendship with Monique would continue long after my service was over, and that I would return to Mali after 8 years away to mourn her death in childbirth, or that I would write a book about our friendship, about her life, and about women's ancient struggles and abiding strengths.
Chris's beautiful first book about her friend is called Monique and the Mango Rains, and she joins us in the studio to tell us more. Welcome.
Thank you.
The Mango Rains?
The Mango Rains were these short, light rains that came when the earth had gone 6 months without any rain in that part of Mali.
They take them very seriously.
They do. They really believe that they come to make the mango sweet. Yeah. So I love the idea of rains when they are least expected.
And there was a lot that was least expected through your whole story. Tell us, first of all, who was Monique? She was 2 years older than you and a midwife, as we know. She was your host. But who else was she?
Well, she was a really charismatic woman who had the most fantastic sense of humor. She could tell a fart joke like no one else, let me tell you. And she was betrothed to her husband at the age of 5. She'd had 3 kids by the time I'd met her, one of whom had died of malnutrition. Mm-hmm. And she had been the village midwife after apprenticing for 2 years with the traditional older midwives and receiving 10 months of medical training.
10 months medical training, 6th grade education, no electricity, no running water, no emergency rooms or ambulances, and as you write, she was responsible for the future of her village.
Yeah, she was the only one around. Yeah. And in sub-Saharan Africa, they have the fewest number of doctors and nurses of anywhere in the world.
You paint a picture of Monique's office, the birthing house. It's pretty astonishing. I mean, it's literally a block of concrete in this corrugated tin-roofed house, the wall worn where so many women have rubbed their backs against it, pushing. Pretty primitive.
Yes. It taught me how little a woman actually needs to give birth.
Except when there's an emergency.
Except when there's an emergency, or a woman has had many children, or she's anemic or malnourished.
What were some of the other challenges that she faced in doing her job? Because she seemed to be a woman way ahead of her time.
She was indeed. I think one of the biggest challenges was that she was the first woman to receive a salary, to be officially employed by the government, and people were not used to that. So even though she was doing this really stressful 24-hour work, she did not receive her salary herself. It went to her father-in-law and her husband, who didn't spend it to meet the family's needs.
And she said she was in an arranged marriage, in a patriarchal society, her money taken away, a diffident husband. She cooked and cleaned for him and his family, carried her child in her back while she delivered others. And she just seemed to really want more. In fact, she took more. She had a special friend in the city.
Yes, she continued to see her childhood love, whose name was Pascal. So I think one of the only things that I could do for Monique, as she was clearly so skilled, is sort of serve as a mirror to some of her ideas. There was no one else in the village that was longing to receive a salary, who was longing to find a way to stop female genital cutting.
Which, 96% of women had some form of
cutting. And Monique quickly realized that that wasn't done to women. women around the world and had really bad health effects. And she was also the first woman to go on birth control. And so she was longing, and despite her lack of resources, putting these things in place for herself and for other women.
What was that like for you? Because you became so close, and you slept on the floor, you had scorpions in your bedding, you know. You lived that life. You and she became, you know, such sisters. But, you know, I just have this image of her with arms outstretched to you, and you go away.
It was very hard to leave, Robin. One of the things that we did was invite Monique to come to the States with us, because I couldn't stand the thought of saying goodbye to her and not having her meet my people and my villagers, if you will. Mm. It was incredible to have her see the States and see what she relished and adored and what she was confused by. I can tell you she loved escalators and elevators. What a great thing that would be in life, to haul water on an escalator.
Yeah.
But I think one of the great things about coming to the States for her was that she saw her own power, I think, for one of the first times, and people were in awe.
Why? So why? What was it that they took away about her?
Just the fact of the amount of work that she was doing and the slow steps she was taking to improve her own village's life in Mali, despite the lack of resources. No running water, no electricity, no emergency equipment, and yet every day she's back on that job with a baby on her back.
Or was. Until. Irony doesn't even seem like an appropriate word for what happened. She, who saved so many lives, birthed so many lives, died on that cement block in childbirth.
Yeah, and their little baby boy died too.
How did she die, by the way? What happened?
Well, she did die in childbirth from complications. When I've talked to different OBs and midwives who do international work, it seems that she probably had undiagnosed high blood pressure. She'd been working so hard that she hadn't gotten prenatal care.
Even though she'd given it or tried to make so many other women have it.
Right.
What should we do with this, Chris Holloway? Because it was just so dispiriting. It was wonderful to meet her.
Hmm.
And then just so, you know, so sad to see this ending. Did it end, you know, the possible growth and modernity in her village? I mean, what happens?
There's wonderful things happening. The midwife currently in Namposala is getting her salary, and she's still working in the birthing house that's holding up despite the rains, Mango and otherwise. Her sister vowed on Monique's grave to become a midwife, and she did. And her daughters are all in school. One of the things that I've done with the book is there's a clinic in Mali that Monique's cousin has started in her honor called Cabinet de Soins Monique in French, or Clinic Under the Care of Monique. And we're calling it Clinique Monique because it sounds nicer. And so proceeds from the book go to fund that.
It's funny. I don't know how you could not write this book. It turns out you can write. Which is like,
what a good thing that is.
Which is a good thing. But, you know, it would seem as if you would have to, because this is what kept her alive.
Yes. And it's part of that story that Maxime is keeping alive with the clinic, and her sister is keeping alive with becoming a midwife. And I feel so lucky to continue to spread the word about who she was.
Yeah. Chris Holloway's book about the midwife she met in Mali during her Peace Corps stint there, who saved so many lives and then lost her own life in childbirth, is called Monique and the Mango Rains. It is a terrific read. And Chris, thank you.
Thanks so much, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.